Denver reminds me of sitting at the edge of that creek with Todd, and how his love helped carry me through those years, and how in some ways it is still carrying me. I wonder if you have people like that in your life, people whose love keeps you going even though they are distant now because of time and geography and everything else that comes between us. Todd and I have both floated down through the decades. He's a doctor now. But the courses of our lives were shaped by those moments we shared upstream. As Maya Jasanoff wrote, a river is nature's plot line. It carries you from here to there. Or from there to here, at least. Outside, the world continues. The river, even overflowing its banks, still meanders. I glance from my laptop screen to the river, then back to the screen, and then to the river. For no reason I know, a memory coalesces. After the academic decathlon competition in Newark was over, we ended up with our Zimas on the roof of that hotel, Todd and me, and a couple of our teammates. It was late at night, and New York City glowed pink in the distance. We were the sixth best academic decathlon team in the nation, and we were getting just the right amount of utility out of our Zimas, and we loved each other. Rivers keep going, and we keep going, and there is no way back to the roof of that hotel. But the memory still holds me together. I give the academic decathlon 4.5 stars. Sunsets. What are we to do about the cliched beauty of an ostentatious sunset? Should we cut it with menace, as Roberto Bolaño did so brilliantly, writing, "The sky at sunset looked like a carnivorous flower"? Should we lean into the inherent sentimentality, as Kerouac does in On the Road when he writes, "Soon it got dusk, a grapey dusk, a purple dusk over tangerine groves and long melon fields, the fields the color of love and Spanish mysteries"? Or perhaps we should turn to mysticism, as Anna Akhmatova did when she wrote that in the face of a beautiful sunset, "I cannot tell if the day is ending, or the world, or if the secret of secrets is inside me again." A good sunset always steals the words from me, renders all my thoughts as gauzy and soft as the light itself. I'll admit, though, that when I see the sun sink below a distant horizon as the yellows and oranges and pinks flood the sky, I usually think, "This looks photoshopped." When I see the natural world at its most spectacular, my general impression is that, more than anything, it looks fake. I'm reminded that in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, tourists would travel around with darkened, slightly convex mirrors called clawed glasses. If you turned yourself away from a magnificent landscape and looked instead at the landscape's reflection in the clawed glass, it was said to appear more picturesque. Named after 17th century French landscape painter Claude Lorraine, the glass not only framed the scene, but also simplified its tonal range, making reality look like a painting. Thomas Gray wrote that only through the clawed glass could he, quote, "see the sunset in all its glory." The thing about the sun, of course, is that you can't look directly at it, not when you're outside, and not when you're trying to describe its beauty. In Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, Annie Dillard writes, "We have really only that one light, one source for all power, and yet we must turn away from it by universal decree. Nobody here on the planet seems aware of this strange, powerful taboo that we all walk around carefully averting our faces this way and that, lest our eyes be blasted forever." In all those senses, the sun is godlike. As T.S. Eliot put it, light is the visible reminder of the invisible light. Like a god, the sun has fearsome and wondrous power, and like a god, the sun is difficult or even dangerous to look at directly. In the book of Exodus, God says, "You cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live." No wonder that Christian writers have for centuries been punning on Jesus as being both kinds of sun. The Gospel according to John refers to Jesus as the light so many times it gets annoying. And there are gods of sunlight everywhere there are gods, from the Egyptian Ra to the Greek Helios to the Aztec Nanahuatzin, who sacrificed himself by leaping into a bonfire so that he could become the shining sun. It all makes a kind of sense. I don't just need the light of that star to survive. I am in many ways a product of its light, which is basically how I feel about God. People ask me all the time if I believe in God. I tell them that I'm Episcopalian or that I go to church, but they don't care about that. They only want to know if I believe in God. And I can't answer them, because I don't know how to deal with that question's in. Do I believe in God? I believe around God, but I can only believe in what I am in: sunlight and shadow, oxygen and carbon dioxide, solar systems and galaxies. But now we're already swimming in sentimental waters. I've metaphorized the sunset. First, it was photoshopped. Now, it's divine. And neither of these ways of looking at a sunset will suffice. E.E. Cummings has a sunset poem that goes, "Who are you, little I, 5 or 6 years old, peering from some high window at the gold of November sunset and feeling that if day has to become night, this is a beautiful way?" It's a good poem, but it only works because Cummings situates the observation in childhood, when one is presumably too innocent to have yet realized how lame it is to write about sunsets. And yet, a good sunset is beautiful, and better still, universally so. Our distant ancestors didn't eat like us or travel like us. Their relationship to ideas as fundamental as time was different from ours. They measured time not primarily in hours or seconds, but mostly in relationship to solar cycles, how close it was to sunset, or to daybreak, or to midwinter. But every human who has lived for more than a few years on this planet has seen a beautiful sunset and paused to spend one of the last moments of the day grateful for and overwhelmed by the light. So, how might we celebrate a sunset without being mawkish or saccharine? Maybe stated in cold facts. Here's what happens. Before a beam of sunlight gets to your eyes, it has many, many interactions with molecules that cause the so-called scattering of light. Different wavelengths are sent off in different directions when interacting with, say, oxygen or nitrogen in the atmosphere. But at sunset, the light travels through the atmosphere longer before it reaches us, so that much of the blue and purple has been scattered away, leaving the sky, to our eyes, rich in reds and pinks and oranges. As the artist Tacita Dean put it, color is a fiction of light. I think it's helpful to know how sunsets work. I don't buy the romantic notion that scientific understanding somehow robs the universe of its beauty, but I still can't find language to describe how breathtakingly beautiful sunsets are. Not breathtakingly, actually, but breath-givingly beautiful. All I can say is that sometimes when the world is between day and night, I'm stopped cold by its splendor, and I feel my absurd smallness. You'd think that would be sad, but it isn't. It only makes me grateful. Toni Morrison once wrote, "At some point in life, the world's beauty becomes enough. You don't need to photograph, paint, or even remember it. It is enough." So what can we say of the cliched beauty of sunsets? Perhaps only that they are enough. My dog, Willie, died a few years ago, but one of my great memories of him is watching him play in the front yard of our house at dusk. He was a puppy then, and in the early evenings he would contract a case of the zoomies. He ran in delighted circles around us, yipping and jumping at nothing in particular, and then after a while he'd get tired, and he'd run over to me and lie down. And then he would do something absolutely extraordinary. He would roll over on his back and present his soft belly. I always marveled at the courage of that, his ability to be so absolutely vulnerable to us. He offered us the place ribs don't protect, trusting that we weren't going to bite or stab him. It's hard to trust the world like that, to show it your belly. There's something deep within me, something intensely fragile, that is terrified of turning itself to the world. I'm scared to even say this out loud, because I worry that having confessed this fragility, you now know where to punch. I know that if I'm hit where I am earnest, I will never recover. It can sometimes feel like loving the beauty that surrounds us is somehow disrespectful to the many horrors that also surround us. But mostly, I think I'm just scared that if I show the world my belly, it will devour me. And so I wear the armor of cynicism and hide behind the great walls of irony and only glimpse beauty with my back turned to it through the clawed glass. But I want to be earnest, even if it's embarrassing. The photographer Alex Soth has said, "To me, the most beautiful thing is vulnerability." I would go a step further and argue that you cannot see the beauty which is enough unless you make yourself vulnerable to it. And so I try to turn toward that scattered light, belly out, and I tell myself, this doesn't look like a picture, and it doesn't look like a god. It is a sunset, and it is beautiful. And this whole thing you've been doing, where nothing gets 5 stars because nothing is perfect, that's bullshit. So much is perfect, starting with this. I give sunsets 5 stars.
Jerzy Dudek's performance on May 25th, 2005. I'd like to tell you a story of joy and wonder and stupidity. It's a sports story, and I've been thinking about it because I am writing to you from May 2020, a moment when sports have, for the first time in my life, stopped. I miss sports. I know sports don't matter in the scheme of things, but I miss the luxury of caring about stuff that doesn't matter. The late Pope John Paul II is reported, probably falsely, to have said, "Of all the unimportant things, football is the most important." And I yearn for the unimportant things at the moment. So here is a football story that begins in southern Poland, only about 60 miles from where Pope John Paul II was born. It's 1984, and a gangly 10-year-old coal miner's son named Jerzy Dudek is living in the tiny coal mining town of Sztygłowice. The mining company has organized a trip for miners' spouses to go underground and see where the miners work. Jerzy and his older brother Darius wait outside the mine with their father as Renata Dudek journeys thousands of feet down into the mine shaft. When she returns, she starts kissing her husband, crying. Dudek would later recall, "She called us over and said, 'Jerzy, Darius, promise me you will never go down the mine. Jersey and his brother just laughed. We were thinking to ourselves, well, what else are we going to do? By then, Pope John Paul II, whom young Jersey idolized, was living in the Vatican, a couple miles away from Rome's Stadio Olimpico, which that year hosted the finals of the European Cup, a big soccer tournament now known as the Champions League, where all the best teams in Europe play one another. That year, the final pitted hometown club AS Roma against my beloved Liverpool Football Club. Side note, I have known the novelist, Radio Ambulante co-founder, and Arsenal fan Daniel Alarcón since high school. Daniel was once asked in an interview if I thought of myself primarily as a YouTuber or as a writer, and to my delight, Daniel answered, "John mostly thinks of himself as a Liverpool fan." Liverpool's goalkeeper at the time, Bruce Grobbelaar, was eccentric even by goalie standards. He warmed up by walking on his hands and hanging off the top of the goal. He often drank a dozen beers on the team bus after a Liverpool loss. But Grobbelaar is best known for that European Cup final in 1984. The game went to a penalty shootout in which, for some reason, Grobbelaar decided to feign wobbly-legged nervousness as one of the Roma penalty takers ran up to shoot. Put off by Grobbelaar's spaghetti legs, the Roma player skied his shot over the crossbar, and Liverpool won their fourth European Cup. Back in southern Poland, young Jerzy Dudek loved football, although leather balls were hard to come by in his impoverished community, so they usually played with rubber balls or even old tennis balls. He ended up becoming a goalkeeper because he was tall, but he didn't start out especially skilled at the position. His first coach told him, "You dive like a sack of potatoes." By 17, Dudek was in training to become a miner, and as part of his vocational training, he worked in the coal mine 2 days a week. In many ways, he liked the work. He enjoyed the camaraderie in the mine, the feeling of mutual reliance. The mine company had a football team, and Jersey began playing for them. He couldn't afford goalie gloves, so he wore his father's work gloves. To make himself feel like a real goalie, he drew an Adidas logo on them. He got better, stopped diving like a sack of potatoes, and by the age of 19, he was making just over $100 a month as the goalkeeper for a semi-pro team while still working for the mine company. But by 21, his progress had stalled. He would later say that he felt himself melting into the grayness. Liverpool Football Club were melting into the grayness, too. By the 1990s, Liverpool often weren't good enough to play in the Champions League, let alone win it. In 1996, when Jerzy Dudek was 22, he caught the attention of a first division Polish team, who signed him to play for a salary of around $400 a month. After that, Dudek's rise was astonishing. Within 6 months, he was transferred to a Dutch team, Feyenoord, where he finally began to make a living wage playing goalie. After a few years with Feyenoord, Dudek signed a multi-million pound contract with Liverpool. But he was miserable. Of the time, he wrote, "The first few days in Liverpool were the worst ones of my life. I felt really lonely. I was in a new place with a new language, which I couldn't speak." All these quotes, by the way, are from Dudek's autobiography, which he titled "A Big Pole in Our Goal." That's the song Liverpool fans sang about him, to the tune of "He's Got the Whole World in His Hands." "We've got a big pole in our goal," etc. ad nauseum. Before we get to May 25th, 2005, I just want to note one more thing. Professional goalkeepers spend a lot of time practicing trying to save penalty kicks. Jerzy Dudek had faced thousands of penalty kicks and he approached them in precisely the same way. He stood stock still in the middle of the goal until a moment before the ball was kicked, and then he dove one way or another. Always, without exception. The 2004-2005 season saw Liverpool go on a magical run through the Champions League, and by April, they were preparing to play the famed Italian club Juventus in the quarterfinals when Pope John Paul II died. Dudek ended up on the bench for that game. He couldn't think straight after the death of his childhood hero and found himself near tears as he confessed to the team doctor that he couldn't play that night. Liverpool won the game nonetheless and eventually made their way to the Champions League final, where they would play another Italian giant, AC Milan. The final was played in Istanbul, and it began horribly for Dudek and Liverpool. 51 seconds into the game, Milan scored. They scored two more goals just before halftime. Dudek's wife, Maria, at home in Poland preparing for their son's first communion, recalled a deathly silence descending over the town. Of the Liverpool locker room at halftime, Dudek wrote, "Everyone was broken." Liverpool defender Jamie Carragher said, "My dreams had turned to dust." The players could hear the 40,000 Liverpool fans singing "You'll Never Walk Alone" in the stands above, but they knew it was, as Carragher put it, in sympathy more than belief. The rest I know by heart because I've seen it so many times. 9 minutes after the second half begins, Liverpool's captain Steven Gerrard scores with a balletic header. Liverpool score again 2 minutes later, and then again 4 minutes after that. Now it's tied 3-3. The match goes into 30 minutes of extra time. Milan pour on the pressure. It is so obvious that they are the better team. Liverpool's players are exhausted, just hoping to get to a penalty shootout. And then, with 90 seconds left in extra time, Jerzy Dudek makes a double save on two point-blank shots that occur within a second of each other. The save is so good that an entire chapter of A Big Pull in Our Goal is devoted to it. The save is so good that even now, 15 years later, when I see replays of it, I still think the Milan player is going to score. But instead, Jerzy Dudek makes the save every time, and the game goes to a penalty shootout. So you're Jerzy Dudek. You've been practicing saving penalties since you were a kid, and you have your way of doing it. You've lain awake at night imagining this moment, the Champions League final, down to penalties, you in goal, standing stock still until the moment before the ball is kicked. But then, in the moments before the shootout begins, Jamie Carragher runs over to you. He jumps on your back and starts shouting. "Kara came up to me like he was crazy," Dudek remembered. "He grabbed me and said, 'Jerzy, Jerzy, Jerzy, remember Bruce Grobbelaar.'" Carragher was screaming at him, "Do the wobbly legs, move around on the goal line, just like in 1984. But that was 21 years before, with different players, a different coach, and a different opponent. What could that moment possibly have to do with this one? There are times in your life when you do things precisely as you have practiced and prepared for them. And then there are times when you listen to Jamie Carragher. So in the most important moment of Jerzy Dudek's professional life, he decided to try something new. His spaghetti legs didn't look exactly like Grobbelaar's had, but he danced on the goal line, his legs wobbling this way and that. "I didn't recognize my husband," Maria Dudek said. "I couldn't believe he danced so crazily in the goal." Liverpool scored all but one of their penalties. For Milan, facing the dancing Dudek, it was a different story. Milan's first penalty taker missed the goal entirely, and then Dudek saved two of the next four penalties, and Liverpool completed what came to be known as the Miracle of Istanbul. Someone tell 10-year-old Jerzy Dudek that he is going to save two penalties in a European Cup final by making the weirdest possible choice. Someone tell 21-year-old Jerzy Dudek playing for $1,800 a year that he is a decade away from lifting the European Cup. You can't see the future coming, not the terrors for sure, but you also can't see the wonders that are coming, the moments of light-soaked joy that await each of us. These days, I often feel like I'm Jerzy Dudek, walking out for the second half, down 3-0, feeling as hopeless as I do helpless. But of all the unimportant things, football is the most important, because seeing Jerzy Dudek sprint away from that final penalty save to be mobbed by his teammates reminds me that someday, and maybe someday soon, I will also be embraced by people I love. It is May of 2020, 15 years since Dudek's spaghetti legs, and this will end, and the light-soaked days are coming. I give Jerzy Dudek's performance on May 25th, 2005, 5 stars. Penguins of Madagascar. Unless you've lived an exceptionally fortunate life, you've probably known someone who enjoys having provocative opinions. I am referring to the people who will say things to you like, "You know, Ringo was the best Beatle." You'll take a breath. Maybe you're out to lunch with this person, because lunch is a time-limited experience, and you can only bear this person's presence in minute quantities. So you'll take a bite of your food, and then you'll sigh again before saying, "Why was Ringo the best Beatle?" Well, the provocative opinion person is very glad you asked. Ringo was the best Beatle because, and then you stop listening, which is the only way to get through lunch. When the person has finished, you say, "Okay, but Ringo also wrote Octopus's Garden," and then the provocative opinion person will regale you with a 14-minute lecture that begins, "Well, actually, Octopus's Garden is a work of considerable genius because..." Most of us are not provocative opinion people, thank God, but I think everyone secretly harbors at least one provocative opinion, and this is mine. The opening sequence of the 2014 film Penguins of Madagascar is one of the greatest scenes in cinematic history. Penguins of Madagascar is an animated kids' movie about the Anthropocene. A villainous octopus named Dave has invented a special ray that makes cute animals ugly so that humans will stop privileging the protection of adorable animals, like penguins, over less adorable ones, like Dave. The movie begins as a faux nature documentary. Antarctica, an inhospitable wasteland, the famous documentary filmmaker Werner Herzog intones with his trademark gravitas. But even here, he tells us, we find life, and not just any life, penguins, joyous, frolicking, waddling, cute, and cuddly life. A long line of penguins marches mindlessly behind an unseen leader. As Herzog calls penguins silly little snow clowns, we follow the line back to the three young penguins at the center of the movie, one of whom announces, "Does anyone even know where we're marching to?" "Who cares?" an adult penguin responds. "I question nothing," another adds. Soon thereafter, the three young penguins are bowled over by an egg rolling downhill. They decide to follow the egg, which tumbles off the edge of a glacier to a shipwrecked boat below. These three little penguins now stand on the edge of a cliff, looking down at an egg about to be devoured by a leopard seal. The penguins must decide, risk it all to save this egg, or watch as it gets eaten. At this point, the camera zooms out, and we see the documentary crew following the penguins. Tiny and helpless, Herzog says, the babies are frozen with fear. They know if they fall from this cliff, they will surely die. And then there is a moment's pause before Herzog says, Gunther, give them a shove. The sound guy uses a boom mic to whack the penguins from behind, forcing them into the great unknown. It's a children's movie, so of course the penguins survive and go on to great adventures. But every time I watch Penguins of Madagascar, I think of how almost all of us are invisible to penguins almost all of the time, and yet we are nonetheless their biggest threat, and also their best hope. In that respect, we are a kind of god, and not a particularly benevolent one. I also find myself thinking about the lemming, a 6-inch-long rodent with pert eyes and a brown-black coat of fur. There are many species of lemmings, and they can be found throughout the colder parts of North America and Eurasia. Most like to be near water and can swim a fair distance. Lemmings tend to have an especially extreme population cycle. Every 3 or 4 years, their populations explode due to favorable breeding conditions. In the 17th century, some naturalists hypothesized that the lemmings must spontaneously generate and then fall from the sky in their millions like raindrops. That belief fell away over time, but another did not. We have long believed that, driven by instinct and/or a willingness to mindlessly follow other lemmings, the creatures self-correct for population growth via mass suicide. This myth has proven astonishingly durable, even though biologists have known for a very long time that lemmings do no such thing. In fact, lemmings spread out when populations become too large, seeking new and safe spaces. Sometimes they come to a river or a lake and attempt to cross it. Sometimes they drown. Sometimes they die of other causes. In all these respects, they are not too different from other rodents. But even now, we still sometimes say that people who unquestioningly follow are lemmings. We think of lemmings this way in no small part because of the 1958 Disney movie White Wilderness, a nature documentary about the North American Arctic. In the film, we watch lemmings migrating after a season of population growth. At last, they come to an oceanside cliff, which the narrator refers to as the final precipice. Casting themselves bodily out into space, the narrator tells us, the lemmings hurl themselves over the cliff in their immense stupidity, and those that survive the fall then swim out into the ocean until they drown, a final rendezvous with destiny and with death, as the movie puts it. But none of this is a realistic depiction of the lemming's natural behavior. For one thing, the subspecies of lemming depicted in the film do not typically migrate. Also, this section of the movie wasn't even filmed in the wild. The lemmings in question were flown from Hudson Bay to Calgary, where much of the lemming footage was shot. And the lemmings did not hurl themselves bodily out into space. Instead, the filmmakers dumped lemmings over the cliff from a truck and filmed them as they fell, and then eventually drowned. Gunther, give them a shove. Today, White Wilderness is remembered not as a documentary about lemmings, but as a documentary about us and the lengths we will go to hold on to a lie. My father is a documentary filmmaker. I learned the White Wilderness story from him. And that's no doubt part of why I love that opening sequence of Penguins of Madagascar. But I also love it because it captures and makes the gentlest possible fun of something about myself I find deeply troubling. Like the adult penguin who stays in line and announces, "I question nothing," I mostly follow rules. I mostly try to act like everyone else is acting, even as we all approach the precipice. We imagine other animals as being without consciousness, mindlessly following the leader to they know not where. But in that construction, we sometimes forget that we are also animals. I am thoughtful, full of thoughts, all the time, inescapably, exhaustingly. But I am also mindless, acting in accordance with default settings I neither understand nor examine. To a degree I don't want to accept, I am what we have long claimed lemmings to be. Forces beyond my comprehension have led me and my fellow lemmings to a precipice, and I fear the shove is coming. The lemmings myth doesn't last because it helps us to understand lemmings. It lasts because it helps us to understand ourselves. Penguins of Madagascar is an exceptionally silly movie, but how else can we confront the absurdities of the Anthropocene? So I stand by my provocative opinion and give the opening sequence of Penguins of Madagascar 4.5 stars. Piggly Wiggly. In 1920, according to census records, my great-grandfather Roy worked at a grocery store in a tiny town in western Tennessee. Like all U.S. grocery stores at the beginning of the 20th century, this one was full service. You walked in with a list of items you needed, and then the grocer, perhaps my great-grandfather, would gather those items. The grocer would weigh the flour or cornmeal or butter or tomatoes and then wrap everything up for you. My great-grandfather's store probably also allowed customers to purchase food on credit, a common practice at the time. The customer would then, usually, pay back their grocery bill over time. That job was supposed to be my great-grandfather's path out of poverty, but it didn't work out that way. Instead, the store closed, thanks in part to the self-service grocery store revolution launched by Clarence Saunders, which reshaped the way Americans shopped and cooked and ate and lived. Saunders was a self-educated child of impoverished sharecroppers. Eventually, he found his way into the grocery business in Memphis, Tennessee, about 100 miles southwest from my great-grandfather's store. Saunders was 35 when he developed a concept for a grocery store that would have no counters, but instead a labyrinth of aisles that customers would walk themselves, choosing their own food and placing it in their own shopping baskets. Prices at Saunders' self-service grocery would be lower because his stores would employ fewer clerks and also because he would not offer customers credit, instead expecting immediate payment. The prices would also be clear and transparent. For the first time, every item in a grocery store would be marked with a price, so customers would no longer fear being shortchanged by unscrupulous grocers. Saunders called his store Piggly Wiggly. Why? Nobody knows. When asked where the name came from, Saunders once answered that it arrived from out of chaos and in direct contact with an individual's mind, which gives you a sense of the kind of guy he was. But usually, when Saunders was asked why anyone would call a grocery store Piggly Wiggly, he would answer, so people will ask that very question. The first Piggly Wiggly opened in Memphis in 1916. It was so successful that the second Piggly Wiggly opened 3 weeks later. 2 months after that, another opened. Saunders insisted on calling it Piggly Wiggly the Third to lend his stores the, quote, royal dignity they are due. He began attaching a catchphrase to his storefront signs, Piggly Wiggly, all around the world. At the time, the stores were barely all around Memphis, but Saunders' prophecies came true. Within a year, there were 353 Piggly Wigglies around the United States. And today, Saunders' concept of self-service aisles really has spread all around the world. In newspaper advertisements, Saunders wrote of his self-service concept in nearly messianic terms. One day, Memphis shall be proud of Piggly Wiggly, one ad read, and it shall be said by all men that the Piggly Wigglies shall multiply and replenish the earth with more and cleaner things to eat. Another time, he wrote, the mighty pulse of the throbbing today makes new things out of old and new things where was nothing before. Basically, Saunders spoke of Piggly Wiggly as today's Silicon Valley executives talk of their companies. We're not just making money here. We are replenishing the earth. Piggly Wiggly and the self-service grocery stores that followed did bring down prices, which meant there was more to eat. They also changed the kinds of food that were readily available. To save costs and limit spoilage, Piggly Wiggly stocked less fresh produce than traditional grocery stores. Prepackaged, processed foods became more popular and less expensive, which altered American diets. Brand recognition also became extremely important because food companies had to appeal directly to shoppers, which led to the growth of consumer-oriented food advertising on radio and in newspapers. National brands like Campbell Soup and Oreo cookies exploded in popularity. By 1920, Campbell was the nation's top soup brand and Oreo the top cookie brand, which they still are today. Self-service grocery stores also fueled the rise of many other processed food brands. Wonder Bread, Moon Pies, Hostess Cupcakes, Bird's Eye Frozen Vegetables, Wheaties Cereal, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, French's Mustard, Klondike Bars, Velveeta Cheese. All of these brands and many more appeared in the U.S. within a decade of the first Piggly Wiggly opening. Clarence Saunders understood the new intersections between mass media and brand awareness better than almost anyone at the time. In fact, during the early 1920s, Piggly Wiggly was the single largest newspaper advertiser in the United States. Keeping prices low and employing fewer clerks also meant many people who worked at traditional grocery stores lost their jobs, including my great-grandfather. There's nothing new about our fear that automation and increased efficiency will deprive humans of work. In one newspaper ad, Saunders imagined a woman torn between her longtime relationship with her friendly grocer and the low, low prices at Piggly Wiggly. The story concluded with Saunders appealing to a tradition even older than the full-service grocer. The woman in his ad mused, "Now, away back many years, there had been a Dutch grandmother of mine who had been thrifty. The spirit of that old grandmother asserted itself just then within me and said, 'Business is business, and charity and alms are another.' Whereupon our shopper saw the light and converted to Piggly Wiggly." By 1922, there were more than 1,000 Piggly Wiggly stores around the U.S., and shares in the company were listed on the New York Stock Exchange. Saunders was building a 36,000-square-foot mansion in Memphis and had endowed the school now known as Rhodes College. But the good times would not last. After a few Piggly Wiggly stores in the Northeast failed, investors began shorting the stock, betting that its price would fall. Saunders responded by trying to buy up all the available shares of Piggly Wiggly using borrowed money, but the gambit failed spectacularly. Saunders lost control of Piggly Wiggly and went bankrupt. His vitriol at Wall Street short sellers presaged contemporary corporate titans, just as his reliance on big advertising and hyper-efficiency did. Saunders was by many accounts a bully, verbally abusive, cruel, and profoundly convinced of his own genius. After losing control of the company, he wrote, "They have it all, everything I built, the greatest stores of their kind in the world, but they didn't get the man that was father to the idea. They have the body of Piggly Wiggly, but they didn't get the soul." Saunders quickly developed a new concept for a grocery store. This one would have aisles and self-service, but also clerks in the meat department and the bakery. Essentially, he invented the supermarket model that would reign into the 21st century. In less than a year, he was ready to open, but the new owners of Piggly Wiggly took him to court, arguing that the use of the Clarence Saunders name in relation to a new grocery store would violate Piggly Wiggly's trademarks and patents. In response, Saunders defiantly named his new grocery store Clarence Saunders, Sole Owner of My Name, perhaps the only business name worse than Piggly Wiggly. And yet, it succeeded tremendously, and Saunders made a second fortune as sole owner stores spread throughout the South. He went on to invest in a professional football team in Memphis, which he named the Clarence Saunders Sole Owner of My Name Tigers. Really. They played the Green Bay Packers and the Chicago Bears in front of huge crowds in Memphis, and they were invited to join the NFL, but Saunders declined. He didn't want to share revenue or send his team to away games. He promised to build a stadium for the Tigers that would seat more than 30,000 people. "The stadium," he wrote, "will have skull and crossbones for my enemies who I have slain." But within a few years, the sole owner stores were crushed by the Depression, the football team was out of business, and Saunders was broke again. Meanwhile, the soulless body of Piggly Wiggly was faring quite well without Saunders. By the supermarket chain's height in 1932, there were over 2,500 Piggly Wigglies in the United States. Even in 2021, there are over 500 locations, mostly in the South, although, like many grocery stores, they are struggling under pressure from the likes of Walmart and Dollar General, which can undercut traditional grocery stores on price, partly by providing even less fresh food and fewer clerks than today's Piggly Wiggly does. These days, Piggly Wiggly ads tend to focus on tradition and the human touch. One North Alabama Piggly Wiggly TV spot from 1999 included this line, "At Piggly Wiggly, it's all about friends serving friends," a call to the kind of human-to-human relationships that Saunders ridiculed in that Dutch grandmother ad. The mighty pulse of the throbbing today does make new things out of old, but it also makes old things out of new. Today, food prices are lower relative to average wage than they've ever been in the United States. But our diets are often poor. The average American ingests more sugar and sodium than they should, largely because of processed prepackaged foods. More than 60% of calories consumed by Americans come from so-called highly processed foods, like the Oreo cookies and Milky Way bars that flourished at early Piggly Wiggly's. Clarence Saunders didn't make any of this happen, of course. Like the rest of us, he was being pulled by forces far larger than any individual. He merely understood what America was about to want and gave it to us. After Saunders' second bankruptcy, he spent decades trying to launch another new retail concept. The Key Doozle was a totally automated store that looked like a massive bank of vending machines and involved purchasing food with almost no human-to-human interaction. But the machines often broke down, and people found the shopping experience slow and clunky. And so the Key Doozle was never profitable. The self-checkout process Saunders envisioned would only become a reality many decades later. As he aged, Saunders grew more vitriolic and unpredictable. He began to suffer from debilitating bouts of mental illness and eventually entered a sanitarium that treated people with anxiety and depression. The mansion Saunders built with his first fortune became the Pink Palace Museum, Memphis's science and history museum. The estate he built with his second fortune became Lichterman Nature Center. In 1936, the journalist Ernie Pyle said, "If Saunders lives long enough, Memphis will become the most beautiful city in the world, just with the things Saunders built and lost." But Saunders never made a third fortune. He died at the Wallace Sanitarium in 1953 at the age of 72. One obituary opined, "Some men achieve lasting fame through success, others achieve it through failure." Saunders was a relentless innovator who understood the power of branding and efficiency. He was also hateful and vindictive. He committed securities fraud. And he helped usher in an era of food that fills without nourishing. But mostly, when I think of Piggly Wiggly, I think about how the big get bigger by eating the small. Piggly Wiggly swallowed up the small-town grocery stores, only to be swallowed itself by the likes of Walmart, which will in turn be swallowed by the likes of Amazon. James Joyce called Ireland the sow that eats her pharaoh. But Ireland has nothing on American capitalism. I give Piggly Wiggly 2.5 stars. The Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Eating Contest. At the corner of Surf and Stillwell Avenues in Brooklyn's Coney Island, there's a restaurant called Nathan's Famous, which started out in 1916 under the ownership of Polish immigrants Nathan and Ida Handworker. The restaurant serves a variety of food, from fried clams to veggie burgers, but Nathan's began as a hot dog place and remains one at its core. A Nathan's hot dog is not the best food you will ever eat, or even the best hot dog you will ever eat. But there's something special about the experience of eating one amid the clamor of Coney Island. And the hot dogs have a pedigree. They've been eaten by King George VI and Jacqueline Kennedy. Stalin supposedly ate one at the Yalta Conference in 1945. Coney Island used to be the huckster capital of the world, where fast-talking barkers wearing straw hats would sell you on this carnival attraction or that one. Now, like all places that survive on nostalgia, it is mostly a memory of itself. The beaches are still packed in summertime, you can still ride the carousel, and there is still a line at Nathan's Famous. But a big part of visiting Coney Island today is imagining how it must have once felt. Except for one day a year, when Coney Island becomes its old self, for better and for worse. Every July 4th, tens of thousands of people flood the streets to witness a spectacular exercise in metaphorical resonance known as the Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Eating Contest. It says so much about contemporary American life that our Independence Day celebrations include, one, fireworks displays, which are essentially imitation battles complete with rockets and bombs, and two, a contest in which people from around the world attempt to discover how many hot dogs and buns can be ingested by a human within 10 minutes. To quote the legendary comedian Yakov Smirnov, "What a country." Like the nation it aims to celebrate, the hot dog eating contest has always been a strange amalgamation of history and imagination. The contest's originator was probably a guy named Mortimer Matz, whom the journalist Tom Robbins described as part P.T. Barnum, part political scalawag. Matz made much of his money as a public relations rep for politicians in crisis, a resource never in short supply in New York. But he also did PR for Nathan's Famous, along with his colleague Max Rosie. Matz claimed that the hot dog eating contest could trace its history back to July 4, 1916, when four immigrants staged a hot dog eating contest to determine which of them loved America the most. But he would later acknowledge, in Coney Island pitchman style, "We made it up." The contest actually started in the summer of 1967, when several people were given an hour to eat as many hot dogs and buns as they could. A 32-year-old truck driver named Walter Paul won the initial contest with a purported 127 hot dogs and buns in a single hour, although bear in mind that number was fed to the press by Rosie and Matz. The event didn't become annual until the late 1970s. Most years, the winner would eat 10 or 11 hot dogs in 10 minutes. The hot dog eating contest was a fairly quiet affair until 1991, when a young man named George Shea became competitive eating's professional hype man. Shea was an English major who loved Flannery O'Connor and William Faulkner and wanted to become a novelist. But instead, he is the last great American carnival barker. He wears a straw hat and is known for his phenomenally grandiloquent annual introductions of the contest's competitors. In fact, Shea's annual pre-show performance, which is broadcast live on America's top sports network, often lasts longer than the hot dog eating contest itself. He always starts out with reasonably normal introductions. Quote, "In his rookie year, he is already ranked number 24 in the world," Shea began one year. "From Nigeria, now residing in Morrow, Georgia, he's eaten 34 ears of sweet corn, 6 feet 9 inches tall. Let's hear it for Gideon OG." But as we meet eater after eater, the introductions become progressively more surreal. Introducing 72-year-old Rich Lefevre, Shea said, "When we are young, we drink our coffee with milk and sugar. And as we age, we drink it with milk only. Then we drink it black. Then we drink it decaf. Then we die. Our next eater is at decaf." Of another eater, we are told, "He stands before us like Hercules himself, albeit a large, bald Hercules at an eating contest." Introducing longtime competitive eater Crazy Legs Conti, who is a professional window washer and the French-cut green bean eating champion of the world, Shea says, "He was first seen standing at the edge of the shore between the ancient marks of the high and low tide, a place that is neither land nor sea. But as the blue light of morning filtered through the darkness, it revealed the man who has been to the beyond and witnessed the secrets of life and death. He was buried alive under 60 cubic feet of popcorn, and he ate his way out to survival." If you don't regularly watch ESPN, it may be difficult to understand just how odd this is compared to its daily fare, which is comprised almost entirely of athletic events and analyses of athletic events. ESPN is not in the business of visiting the place that is neither land nor sea. But ESPN is a sports network, and I'll concede that competitive eating is a sport. Like any sport, this one is about seeing what a human body can accomplish. And like any sport, it has a variety of rules. You have to eat the hot dog and the bun for it to count, and you're immediately disqualified if during the competition you experience a so-called reversal of fortune, the sport's euphemism for vomiting. The competition itself is, of course, gruesome. These days, the winner usually consumes over 70 hot dogs and buns in 10 minutes. One can feel something akin to joyful wonder at the magnificence of a perfectly weighted Megan Rapinoe cross or the elegance of a LeBron James fadeaway. But it's hard to construct the Nathan's Famous hot dog eating contest as beautiful. When a soccer ball is at Lionel Messi's feet, you don't want to look away. When watching competitive hot dog eating, you can't bring yourself to look away. The hot dog eating contest is a monument to overindulgence, to the human urge to seek not just more than you need, but also more than you actually want. But I think it's also about something else. The world's best competitive eater, the American Joey Chestnut, has said of Shea's introductions, "He convinces the audience these guys are athletes. He does such a good job, he convinces me I'm an athlete." The carnival barker is an obvious flim-flam artist. We know that Shea is kidding when he refers to Chestnut as America itself and claims that the first words Chestnut's mother ever told him were, quote, "You are of my flesh, but you are not mine own. Fate is your father, and you belong to the people, for you shall lead the army of the free." We know that's a joke. And yet, people scream along. They chant, "Joey, Joey, Joey." As the announcer continues to rile the crowd, they begin to chant, "USA, USA." The energy on the street changes. We know that Shea isn't speaking in earnest. And yet, his words have power. Beginning in 2001, a Japanese man named Takeru Kobayashi won the hot dog eating contest for 6 consecutive years. Kobayashi totally revolutionized the approach to the competition. Before him, no one had ever eaten more than 25 hot dogs. Kobayashi ate 50 in 2001, more than double what the third-place eater that year managed. His strategies, including breaking each dog in half and dipping the bun in warm water, are now ubiquitous at the contest. Kobayashi was long beloved as the greatest eater of all time, although he now no longer participates in the contest because he refuses to sign an exclusive contract with Shea's company. But he competed in the 2007 event, and when the Japanese Kobayashi was beaten by the American Chestnut, Shea shouted into the microphone, "We have our confidence back. The dark days of the past 6 years are behind us." And that seemed to give the crowd permission to fall into bigotry. You can hear people shout at Kobayashi as he walks over to congratulate Chestnut. They tell him to go home. They call him Kamikaze and Shanghai Boy. Recalling this in a documentary more than a decade later, Kobayashi wept as he said, "They used to cheer for me." When you have the microphone, what you say matters, even when you're just kidding. It's so easy to take refuge in the just of just kidding. It's just a joke. We're just doing it for the memes. But the preposterous and absurd can still shape our understanding of ourselves and one another. And ridiculous cruelty is still cruel. I love humans. We really would eat our way out of 60 cubic feet of popcorn to survive. And I'm grateful to anyone who helps us to see the grotesque absurdity of our situation. But the carnival barkers of the world must be careful which preposterous stories they tell us, because we will believe them. I give the Nathan's Famous Hot Dog Eating Contest 2 stars. CNN. America's first 24-hour nonstop news network was launched by cable magnate Ted Turner on June 1, 1980. The inaugural broadcast began with Turner standing behind a podium speaking to a large crowd outside CNN's new headquarters in Atlanta. Turner said, "You'll notice out in front of me that we've raised 3 flags, one the state of Georgia, second the United States flag, of course, which represents our country and the way we intend to serve it with the cable news network, and over on the other side, we have the flag of the United Nations, because we hope that the cable news network, with its international coverage and greater depth coverage, will bring a better understanding of how people from different nations live and work together, so that we can perhaps hopefully bring together in brotherhood and kindness and friendship and peace the people of this nation and this world." After Turner spoke, CNN began covering the news. Its first stories were about the attempted assassination of a black civil rights leader in Indiana and a shooting spree in Connecticut. That first hour of CNN looks dated. Its anchors wear broad lapelled suits and sit in a flimsy studio, but it sounds very much like contemporary CNN on a Sunday afternoon. The broadcast careens from breaking news story to breaking news story, from fires to shootings to emergency plane landings. Even in that first hour, you can hear the rhythm of the news, the ceaseless pulse of it. Also, the 1980 cable news sets, like most news sets today, had no windows, for the same reason casinos have no windows. These days, there's usually crisp blue light in the background as the news anchors talk. You don't know whether it's morning or night, and it doesn't matter, because the news beats on.